with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
Are young adults getting enough exercise to reduce their chances of developing high blood pressure? We'll learn the answer from a researcher at the University of California, San Francisco. Then, 50,000 Americans lose their lives each year to thoracic aortic aneurysms. On this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment, a Mayo Clinic cardiovascular surgeon explains what you need to know about this silent killer. And do you simply pay a medical bill right when it arrives? We'll talk to an author who explains why and how smart consumers should carefully check those bills for inaccurate or unfair charges. Stay with us. Med Clinic Radio gets underway in just a moment.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Are young adults exercising enough to reduce the chances of getting hypertension, commonly called high blood pressure, later in life? A recent study from the University of California, San Francisco suggests the answer is no and calls for more exercise than current guidelines recommend. Here to sort out the study is Dr. Jason Nagata, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics in the University's Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine. The American Journal of Preventive Medicine published the study. Doctor, the study looked at how much exercise young adults should do to ward off hypertension in midlife. What is the, sweet spot for the number of hours?
Currently, the guidelines are that people should engage in about 2.5 hours of moderate intensity physical activity per week. So that averages to about 30 minutes per day, 5 days a week. But we actually found in studying over 5,000 participants from around the United States that actually that wasn't enough to prevent the development of hypertension. And actually twice that amount, so 5 hours a week, or about an hour a day for 5 days a week, was actually what was required to prevent high blood pressure.
And just to be clear, give us some examples of what's considered moderate types of exercise.
Moderate exercise or physical activity is like kind of a brisk walk, or gardening activity would be like lawn mowing, or like a easy bike or swim, but not quite as intense as going on like a full-on run or like playing soccer or something like that. So it's not super intense, but it still is going to get your heart rate pumping a little bit more than normal.
And when you compared those who exercised moderately, as you say, for 5 hours a week during early adulthood versus those who didn't, how much did the 5 hour a week crowd cut their risk of developing hypertension?
Overall, we found that that actually decreased your risk by about 20%. So you're 20% less likely to develop hypertension later in adulthood. And I think that it's also important to note that actually getting that level, even when you're 18 years old, so as a young adult, was also about 20% protective of developing hypertension. So maintaining a high level of moderate physical activity, especially when these 18 and 20s, is important for preventing hypertension.
And even better yet, for those who kept exercising at least 5 hours a week until age 60, how was their likelihood of developing hypertension?
It was also notable that both being more active as a young adult and then also maintaining physical activity, both of those were independent protective factors for developing hypertension. So regardless of what you did later on in life, being more active at age 18 helped with preventing hypertension. But regardless of what you did at age 18, the sort of pathway that you had later on was important. And I think one thing that we also were not surprised at, but I think was very noteworthy, was that people are actually usually most active when they're young adulthood. So, you know, when people are finishing up high school, they sort of may be at peak performance, they may be participating in sports teams, they have PE requirements, and then there's a big drop when people enter the workforce or become parents or, you know, have a number of life transitions when you're becoming adults. And so I do think that that young adult period is really important for people to maintain activity.
And did simply meeting the current guideline of 2.5 hours a week of moderate exercise do anything at all to reduce a young person's risk of hypertension?
Based on our data, it didn't. But this was, again, looking specifically at high blood pressure. There are, you know, other studies that show benefits of physical activity for other outcomes like mental health and, you know, potentially, you know, a number of other health benefits. But we didn't see an effect specifically for high blood pressure.
We're visiting with Dr. Jason Nagata, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, regarding their recent research on how much exercise young adults should be getting to guard against high blood pressure later in life. Now, Doctor, your findings were grouped into four. There's black men, black women, white men, and white women. Which group reported the lowest physical activity from young adulthood, and what were that group's hypertension rates over time?
The study actually looked at four different groups, so black and white race, and then male and female. And overall, black women had the lowest rates of physical activity from young adulthood through the later adult life. Overall, men had higher physical activity levels at age 18 or in this young adult period. But one thing that was notable was that actually black men had steeper declines through adulthood than white men did. And so while they both started off quite active, by the time that black men reached their 50s or 60s, they had much greater declines in physical activity than white men.
And from the big picture, you report that data from national surveys estimates that 2/3 of American adults ages 55 to 64 have hypertension, which is a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease, which is in turn the leading cause of death. How big of a wake-up call is your study?
I think that it's really important that people are aware that by later adulthood or as people are entering their 50s or 60s, a large proportion of Americans actually have high blood pressure. And as you mentioned, this is a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease, which is the top cause of death in the U.S. So I think it's really important that Americans, you know, get their blood pressure checked regularly and get it treated if they do develop that. But we've identified that physical activity, particularly in that critical young adult age window, is really important way of preventing high blood pressure.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, more about this study of young adults' level of exercise and why what happens in our 20s could have a big impact later in life. Back in a moment.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Dr. Jason Nagata from the University of California, San Francisco, whose study is published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. The study concludes that young adults may need to double the recommended level of moderate exercise to ward off hypertension later in life. Doctor, as you hinted before, you looked at 5,100 people in the four groups, black and white men and women, ages 18 to 30, whose physical activity was recorded over 30 years. So let's take these groups one at a time. Can you quantify how much physical activity black men got at the outset and what happened to that exercise level over time?
Black men actually had the highest rates of physical activity when they were 18 to 30, so in their young adult period. On average, that meant that they were just about getting that 5 hours a week that we found was protective of high blood pressure. However, as black men aged, and we followed these participants for 30 years, so until they were about 60 years old, we actually found that black men had the steepest declines in physical activity of the four groups, such that by the time that they were age 60, their physical activity levels were actually lower on average than white men and also lower than white women. And so I think that these disparities are really important because we also had noted that black men have quite high rates of high blood pressure as well. So I do think that preventing these declines in this population is really important. Black women on average started with the lowest levels of physical activity, and that persisted as they approached age 60. So of all the four age groups, black women had the lowest rates of physical activity overall. So I think this is also an important message that we should really be encouraging sports and PE participation, particularly among black girls, teenage girls, and as they are developing into young adults.
And Contrast that with white women. What were their rates of activity, and were they fairly stable?
Overall, white women at age 18 to 30, on average, had lower rates of physical activity than white men or than black men, but they had actually the least declines of the different populations. And so their activity level stayed pretty stable from 18 through age 60. And so, as I mentioned earlier, they actually, by age 60, are on average doing more activity than black men because that population has such steep declines.
And I noted from your study that the white women were reported to have approximately 350 what you called exercise units per week, which I think translates into 2.5 hours of moderate exercise. So white women are basically now, as a group, at least the ones in your study, are as a group exercising at about the current guidelines. Is that right?
Yeah, on average, they're a little bit above the current guideline level.
And white men, where did they start and where did they end up? And did they plateau?
White men started at the highest levels at age 18, just like the black men. So they were just about meeting 5 hours of physical activity per week. And they did have some declines through age 30 to 35, but then they plateaued around age 35, such that by age 40 beyond, white men had the highest levels of physical activity, whereas they were pretty much on par with black men in young adulthood. So I think that overall, we do see that while there were some declines in the white men, the overall white men and women were able to maintain their physical activity more than black men and black women. And I think this is a notable disparity, especially for public health and professionals and clinicians.
We've been talking about a recent study showing that young adults may need to get twice the recommended amount of exercise to stave off hypertension. Our guest is Dr. Jason Nagata from the University of California, San Francisco. So, doctor, as every group went down in exercise, a chart in your study showed that every group went up in the incidence of hypertension. How did each group fare by age 60?
We do know that as people age, their risk for hypertension does increase. The findings in hypertension disparities sort of mirrored those in physical activity disparities. So overall, we found that actually white women had the lowest rates of high blood pressure throughout the whole life course, so from age 18 to age 60. The group that had the highest rates of hypertension across the life course were black men. And again, that's, I think, really important to note that they also were the population that had the steepest declines in physical activity. And so I think that's a really important way that we could intervene on preventing high blood pressure in that population. And then in the middle were white men and black women. And around age 45 or so, those two middle groups switch. So before age 45, white men actually have the second highest rates of high blood pressure. But then after age 45, black women actually surpass them. So that by age 60, black men and black women have the highest rates of high blood pressure, then followed by white men, and the lowest are white women overall.
And I think the numbers were roughly 80 to 90% of black men and women developed hypertension by age 60, white men just below 70%, and white women approximately 50%. And doctor, your study adjusted for factors that could possibly affect the results. What were some of these so-called confounding variables?
We actually looked at, in addition to, you know, dividing by the race and sex groups, we looked at education, a family history of high blood pressure or cardiovascular disease, and also some behaviors such as smoking and alcohol, and also their weight or body mass index.
And you wrote, and you kind of mentioned before, that findings indicate young adulthood is an important window, you use those words, when physical activity declines in all race and sex groups. What really happens between high school and real life regarding exercise?
Overall, studies have found that people generally peak in their athletic performance and physical activity levels when they're finishing up high school. This is often the time that people are most engaged in sports, if they have, you know, team sports or varsity sports opportunities. And most people have some degree of a PE, like physical education requirement, when they're in high school. When people finish that and either go off to college or go off to work, there's a big decline. For those who are entering the workforce, often workplaces, you know, don't have that same kind of environment where there's a physical activity requirement or even opportunity. You know, there are fewer opportunities for team type sports. And even in college, while there often are, you know, obviously there is college level athletics, you know, you have to be kind of an elite athlete to, for the most part, to participate in that. So a lot of people who were just generally participating but were not at that high level will often drop out as well. And so I think that one thing that we can do as a society is to really try to promote physical activity during this transition to adulthood, because this seems like it's a really important time. And that's why I referred to it as a sort of a critical window, when people really seem to lose steam in terms of their physical activity. And we're seeing that this may really increase their rates of high blood pressure later in life.
So that could be a public policy recommendation. Let me ask you, Doctor, what other recommendations to primary healthcare professionals would you make?
There have actually been studies that show that compared to other healthy lifestyle behaviors, doctors ask about physical activity and encourage physical activity the least. It's pretty common that people check your weight and talk about diet and smoking and alcohol, but often clinicians talk about physical activity the least, or provide sort of guidance in terms of physical activity the least to their patients. And so I do think it's an untapped area that doctors could encourage people a little bit more, or try to problem solve how to get people more active, especially in that young adult period and through middle age.
Sounds good. Dr. Jason Nagata, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, 50,000 Americans lose their lives each year to thoracic aortic aneurysms. We'll learn the warning signs from a Mayo Clinic cardiovascular surgeon next on MedClinic Radio.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Joel Streed. If you think you're hearing more about people with celiac disease, you're correct.
There is good evidence that celiac disease is truly more common. It's not just that we're better at finding it.
While it's not exactly clear why more people are developing the disease, which is an immune reaction to eating gluten, Dr. Joseph Murray explained some possible factors.
Wheat itself probably hasn't changed very much in the last 100 years. What we do with the wheat has changed. How we make our bread has changed.
He says there may also be a dose effect of gluten in those who are at a genetic risk.
The most recent work suggests that very young children who are at genetic risk for celiac disease, if they get more gluten in childhood, they're more likely to develop celiac disease.
If untreated, celiac disease can cause anemia, infertility, bone weakening, and even severe complications such as cancer. For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to MedClinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Now, an important look at a potentially deadly condition, often with no symptoms. With this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment, here's Dee Dee Steepen.
A thoracic aortic aneurysm is a weakened area in the major blood vessel that feeds blood to the body, the aorta. When the aorta is weak, blood pushing against the vessel wall can cause it to bulge like a balloon. This is called an aneurysm. Now, depending on the cause, size, and growth rate of your thoracic aortic aneurysm, treatment options can vary. Joining us to discuss is Mayo Clinic cardiovascular surgeon, Dr. Gabor Bagomeri. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
How common is this problem?
In the United States alone, the aortic aneurysm responsible approximately over 50,000 deaths annually. If you want to put it into context, it's probably the 19th leading cause of death in all ages, and probably the 15th leading cause of death above age of 65. Now, unfortunately, this number is probably underestimating the true burden of the aortic aneurysm. Most of the time, this aortic aneurysm is sudden onset, presenting with most commonly death. So it's falsely misrepresented as heart attack or other sudden reason of sudden death. So if you look at the autopsy series, probably behind the sudden death, approximately 2 to 9% of the sudden death is related to the aneurysm.
Okay. And so are there any signs or symptoms patients should be aware of, or is this kind of a silent condition?
Unfortunately, the aortic aneurysm most of the time is a silent killer. It's very insidious. It's asymptomatic. When it causes symptoms, it's usually when it represents as an acute aortic syndrome, meaning tear or rupture, and then it needs emergency treatment. Sometimes they can be noticed some other symptoms and the aneurysm gets bigger. It can cause compression in the surrounding structures. Some people can presenting with some dysphagia, difficulty swallowing because compressing on a foot pipe or difficulty breathing or maybe compressing some nerves. But unfortunately, most of the time, the aneurysm, until it gets to the tipping point when it becomes unstable, it can cause acute aortic syndrome. It's mostly asymptomatic.
And so you've pretty much touched on this, but if you could just reiterate the danger of having a thoracic aortic aneurysm.
Problem is, I tell my patients, similar like a balloon. The bigger it gets, the wall is going to weaken. And at some point, the structural integrity will be compromised. Most of the time, it can cause rupture. And it's unfortunately suddenly ends up with sudden death or even tear when you get very sick and you need emergent surgery or care.
Great segue into the next question, which is how is this condition managed? Is it watchful waiting, preventative surgery, or is this an emergency surgery situation?
If we know that somebody has aortic aneurysm, then when it's reached certain size, we recommend that you seek out a cardiologist who is experienced managing thoracic aortic aneurysm or surgeons who is comfortable and doing a lot of aortic surgery. Most of the time, we're following serial imaging, and then we operate when it gets to the point when the risk of rupture gets higher than the risk of surgery. Now, in emergency settings, when it's sudden onset, you didn't know about it. Most of the time, unfortunately, it happens in emergency settings, and you have to rush to the local emergency room. So if you have the most common presenting symptoms, the most commonly is pain, sudden onset of chest pain. Of course, many other medical conditions can present with the similar symptoms, but probably that's the most common presenting symptoms.
Let's talk about how or why does this occur in some people? Are there risk factors?
There are multiple etiology why aortic aneurysm can happen. The aorta is the largest vessel which is carrying all the fresh blood. And it's slowly tapering. It starts at the heart and it travels upwards and turns and travels down and gradually tapers. As you are getting older, in from mid-adulthood to the late adulthood, there's a slow progressive growth in everybody. The majority of the aneurysm is sporadic or degenerative, meaning there is no known risk factors apart from the known underlying atherosclerotic risk factors like hypertension, hyperlipidemia. Some people, especially when they present aneurysm before the 6 or 7 decades in their 30s or 40s, they always have to have a high index of suspicion. Maybe they have underlying genetic predisposition.
Should other first-degree family members be tested?
That's a very good question. As I said before, the majority, probably over two-thirds, is sporadic, no non-genetic predisposition. But in younger person, there is always have to assume that maybe some underlying genetic. If it happens in a younger age, it's always good to get a full evaluation, cardiology and genetic. There are certain genetic testing panels available. Currently, we have probably over 20 genes we can test. And then as year goes by, we're always discovering more and more. If you have known family members who had previous aortic aneurysm, needed surgery, or a head dissection, needed emergent surgery, it's always good to get first-degree relatives and sometimes even a second-degree relatives because it can skip generation to get a screening test. And most commonly, probably the first screening tool is a non-invasive echocardiogram. It's a very good screening tool.
Tell us about how the aortic valve may also be affected.
The first part of the aorta, when it starts at the heart, is called the aortic root where the aortic valve sits. Normally, most of our aortic valves, we have a tricuspid aortic valve, and if you look and fast, look at the valve, it looks should look like a Mercedes sign. There are very common congenital problem with the aortic valve, and the most common is the bicuspid aortic valve. It's hereditary. It's 1 or 2% of the population. It's very common. Most people don't know about it. Sometimes it can be misdiagnosed because early in the life, they hear some innocent murmur, and it's always at least a suspicion that you might have bicuspid aortic valve. And with the bicuspid aortic valve, there is some association, increased risk of aneurysm formation. It's not as bad like with other connective tissue disorder like the Marfan disease, but it's also good to know. If you know that somebody in your family had like a bicuspid aortic valve, unicuspid aortic valve, then definitely the first degree relatives, they should be screened not just for bicuspid valve itself, but for their associated aortopathy like aortic aneurysm.
Could you talk about Mayo's approach to treatment? What types of surgery are offered?
At Mayo Clinic, we offer a whole wide spectrum of aortic surgery, including open or endovascular minimally invasive surgery. Our approach is we have a multidisciplinary approach. So it involves multiple specialties with a very close collaboration. We have a thoracic aortic clinic when the patients are seen. And the treatment team include the cardiologist, of course, the cardiac surgeon. Most of the patients, especially the genetically driven diseases, they have other musculoskeletal problems. Orthopedic surgeons, they can have eye problems, so ophthalmologists. And last but not least, also the genetic evaluation advising predisposition, and they can advise you about the genetic testing and its implication, especially for your offspring. And also the radiologists who are reading the different imaging studies, and these radiologists are specifically treated in reading of cardiac and aortic disease.
Very good. Dr. Bhagamari, is there anything else that you think is important for patients to know?
It's common, but obviously it's not an everyday. Most of this aneurysm discovered incidentally. Nowadays, the imaging modalities are more widespread. Going to the doctors, sometimes you have an echocardiogram and they get an incidental finding. The most important, when your aorta is enlarged, especially when it gets above 4 centimeters, in normal adult, the aorta shouldn't be larger than 4 centimeters. When it gets to that point, I think you should seek medical attention and get connected. Either it's a cardiologist or cardiac surgeon whose expertise and really focusing in this disease. I recommend that patients should go in centers when they're doing high volume of these surgeries and they have a close multidisciplinary approach, not just the cardiologist or cardiac surgeon, but all specialties, because this patient needs lifelong surveillance and not just replacing the aorta, but blood pressure management, etc.
Our thanks to Mayo Clinic cardiovascular surgeon, Dr. Gabor Bhagamari. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
You can find Mayo Clinic Q&A wherever you get and subscribe to your favorite podcasts. To see a list of all Mayo Clinic podcasts, visit newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. Up next, we'll learn why smart consumers carefully examine their medical bills before paying them as MedClinic Radio continues.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Many Americans are burdened with exorbitant healthcare costs, but do you know how to read a medical bill to be sure it's accurate and fair? Marshall Allen is a reporter for ProPublica, where he covers the healthcare industry. He's a Pulitzer Prize finalist and recipient of the Harvard Kennedy School's Goldsmith Prize for Investigative Reporting. Now he's author of Never Pay the First Bill and Other Ways to Fight the Healthcare System and Win. Marshall, many healthcare consumers think, why bother scrutinizing a medical bill because an insurance company pays what's left after the deductible? Tell us why people should actually look at each medical bill carefully.
Well, two of the key words that you used there were after the deductible. Unfortunately, deductibles have gotten so high in recent years that many Americans are paying the first $1,000, $3,000, $5,000, even $10,000. In fact, most people never even meet their deductible. So in many cases, you're going to be paying 100% of that bill. So you better look at it. And then even if your insurance plan covers it, you're still going to get hit with the coinsurance cost. I mean, that's the often 20% or 30% of the overall payment that gets passed on to you. And that's even after you get hit with your deductible. So I know it's kind of paralyzing or complicated, or we tend to want to just shove that bill into a drawer and never look at it again. But we've got to be looking at these medical bills. I compare this to when you were a young adult or even a teenager and you started learning how to use a checking account. You know, you had to like balance your checkbook and you had to track the payments and make sure that you were looking at your statements to see if there were fees on there, or a credit card, you know, you're looking for any payments that shouldn't have been on there. This is the same type of financial literacy. And just like it was a little confusing when you learned those skills, you have to get over that confusion or that paralysis that you feel, because frankly, these medical bills are so much more money than most of us have in our bank accounts that we can save hundreds or even thousands of dollars every time we scrutinize these bills. And so that's why it's so important to take a look at them.
Let's discuss some of your specific advice. First, you say do not pay the bill right away. Now, that doesn't mean to just
put it in the drawer, as you said a moment ago, you're saying scrutinize it before you pay it, right?
That's exactly right. I don't say don't pay your bills. I mean, that's obviously not a good idea. But never pay the first bill until you have made sure that it is accurate and to make sure that it's fairly priced. So if you talk to experts who review medical bills for a living, and I have talked to a lot of them, they will tell you that most medical bills that they see have some type of an error in them. They either have a charge for something that never occurred, or they'll often have what's called upcoding, which may be a very simple service occurred, something really easy like a quick examination, but then they'll use a billing code that inflates the complexity of that service to make it sound like it was harder than it was. It's like if you went to get your car washed and they charged you for detailing your car. You know, there's a big difference. When you only got it washed, you shouldn't be paying for the detail. And that's what upcoding is. You did get the wash, but they're charging you a lot more than they should. So the way you check that is get an itemized bill. So anytime you go to the doctor or the hospital, they're often going to give you a bill that's like a lump sum payment. Pay this amount for physician services or for medical services or pharmacy. You need to get them to break that bill down. Itemize it, just like a bill you'd get from a grocery store, where it lists the individual charge for each individual service. And then remember those billing codes. Ask them, make sure that that itemized bill has the actual billing codes that they submitted to your insurance plan to get paid. And if the hospital won't give it to you, get it from your insurance company. You can call customer service and they can easily give you the codes that were used on your bill. Once you have those codes, then you can look them up. You can look them up online and see if they describe the quick car wash like you received or some kind of a detailed job that you didn't actually receive. And then you want to contest them if they're inaccurate. Or if you didn't even get the car wash and you see a bill for a car wash, then you absolutely want to contest that one. And then you want to price those codes. You can go to a couple places to price codes. Right now, there's just been a game changer in healthcare pricing, where American hospitals are required by the federal government to post their prices for all the services they provide. They have to post the cash price on their website, the Medicare price, and every price that they've negotiated with all the different insurance companies that they accept. Once you see those prices on the hospital website, you can look at your bill and see if your insurance company's rate or the rate that they're charging you is fair compared to what the other insurance companies are paying. It's not fair to make one patient pay many times more than some other patient for the exact same service. And yet that's what happens in healthcare every day. The whole system is built on secrecy and based on us not checking. And that way they can charge one patient way more than another patient just because of their type of insurance plan. It's not because they got a different quality or a different type of care. And so if you identify these overcharges and this price gouging, frankly, is what it is, then you can contest that. You have the evidence you need to go back to that billing department and say, hey, this never happened, and yet I see it on my bill. You need to remove that from my bill. And hey, this is something where I'm looking at the Blue Cross plan. They pay half as much as my plan pays. I'm not going to pay more than some other patient who's just covered by some other insurance. You can't discriminate me based on my insurance plan. And so then we have to push back and we have to demand a fair deal from these healthcare providers.
Is it possible to also, for example, look at the prices on the website of Hospital A and then check the website of Hospital B and compare their prices? And if you're being overcharged by Hospital A, can you go back and essentially negotiate?
Absolutely. So first of all, they make up all their initial charges anyway. They pull it out of thin air, and then they expect insurance companies to negotiate based on those inflated charges. We can absolutely negotiate for everything. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to comply, but here's what I think the secret weapon is for consumers. Small claims court. We can sue them in small claims court for the amount that they are overcharging us. If they won't comply, it costs about $30 to file a case in small claims court. It's our constitutional right to be protected by the American justice system against predatory businesses that are charging us more than they should be. I think this is a game changer because the limits are a lot bigger in small claims court than you would think. I mean, in Texas, the limits are $20,000. Tennessee, the limit's $25,000. Where I live in New Jersey, you can sue for up to $15,000 without needing an attorney. And so patients just need to think about this problem differently. And if they understood how the system works, how the incentives work against them, they could be empowered to push back and to fight back and actually come out on top.
We're talking with Marshall Allen, a reporter for ProPublica and also the author of Never Pay the First Bill. Marshall, let's talk for a moment about unnecessary care. Is that common? And how can someone who's not gone to medical school know what's needed and what's not?
We have an epidemic of unnecessary care in the United States. In most cases, doctors and hospitals get paid on a fee-for-service schedule. So basically, they get a fee when they perform a service. And this is why there's a lot of unnecessary care, because the incentives are not aligned to protect us from care that we don't need. In fact, they estimate that up to 25% of all the medical care being provided is unnecessary. So the main question I think that we should ask, if you're going to the doctor or your nurse practitioner and they're saying, hey, we think you should do this treatment or this procedure or put you on this medication or you need this MRI, ask them this question. What happens if I don't do this? What's the risk to me of not doing this right now? What if we wait? That question will require that medical provider to reframe the conversation in terms of what the risk is to not taking action, instead of just assuming that you're going to take their advice and take action. And often what you find is that there isn't a great risk. There isn't a great immediate urgent need to do that service right now. And so then you can wait. You can look up the things online and learn more about it. You can get a second opinion from another doctor if that's something that would be smart. And the thing you don't want to assume is don't assume that any of these things are going to be not harmful to you and low cost. In fact, sometimes the simplest thing, like a lab test, can cost you an exorbitant amount of money. When we all start doing this more, and when we team up with our employers to be smarter about the way we engage with the healthcare system, we're gonna be able to turn this thing around. I really have confidence that we will.
You also say you might save money by not using your insurance. That would probably be a surprise to most people. So can you give us some examples of how that might be wise?
Yeah, so here's how crazy our healthcare system has become, our payment system. You know, you have an insurance plan because they promise you that they've negotiated some great price for you. But there are many times, now not every time, and I'm not saying it's even most of the time, but there are many times where the cash price is lower than the insurance company's negotiated discounted price. So always ask for the cash price. I'll give you an example. A friend of mine here in New Jersey, she actually became a friend because I helped her with her medical bill, but she emailed me and she was getting, you know, a very large bill for a simple visit to her emergency room. She was able to get her billing codes and get her itemized bill, and she saw the bulk of the bill came from this level 3 emergency room examination. When she looked at the hospital's website, she could see that her United Healthcare plan had negotiated a price of $5,800 just for this quick emergency room exam. Meanwhile, the Blue Cross price was $700, the Medicare price was about $230, and the cash price, believe it or not, was $256. So in other words, the cash price was 22 times lower than her United Healthcare insurance negotiated discounted price. And that's just an outrageous example of how sometimes going in and not using your insurance is a better deal than running things through your insurance plan.
Marshall Allen from ProPublica, the author of Never Pay the First Bill and Other Ways to Fight the Healthcare System and Win. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And that's MedClinic Radio for this week. MedClinic Radio is a production of Syndication Networks. If you would like to listen to past shows, check out our website, medclinicradio.com.
Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you join us again next week for another edition of MedClinic Radio. Syndication.